Good evening, everybody. My name's Dave. I'm an alcoholic. And I have a sponsor. Well, my sobriety date is August 4th, 2005. I have a sponsor. His name's Jack. Some of you might know him. New Jack. Not Jack that everybody knows. From Midtown. But one. My hometown is, or home group is Midtown. Excuse me. I just got nervous as soon as I walked up here. I was fine all the way up here, but that's all right. I'll just look at Billy and become serene, I guess. Billy, thank you for asking me to come up here. I've been looking forward to doing it. I enjoy this group a lot. I've got a chance to come up here with friends. And one time when my sponsor came up here to hear them speak, and I always like coming up here. It's a beautiful area, and you guys, and it's a beautiful group. You guys really do the deal around here, and I can tell how enthusiastic everybody is about Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, just by coming into the room. And, you know, whenever you, sometimes I'll go out of town and catch a meeting someplace, and, you know, I have to stick my hand out when I go into the meeting. It's always a little disheartening, but it's never the case when I came here. People always introduce themselves, were real friendly, make conversation, make sure that I know where the coffee, the bathroom, everything is. And that is really a testament to Alcoholics and how Alcoholics Anonymous works. Because when I got here, I was really scared, nervous, felt out of place, skin was crawling, was so worried about what everybody thought about me. That's what you guys did was exactly what was done for me when I was brand new. And I was shown how to live a life in Alcoholics Anonymous where I could be comfortable in my own skin, you know, and that was not just at the meeting, but it was like a whole new way of life. You know, because when I got here, I didn't know anything but drinking, lying, stealing, cheating, and everything else. And a lot of the character defects that I know now that I have, I've looked at as assets. Like I was a great liar, and I thought, you know, that's something that will help me get an advantage over in life and help me get to where I need to go. And people in Alcoholics Anonymous taught me how to not do that, be honest and be truthful, and how much farther that can get me. And it's things like that that have made me be comfortable in my own skin. So, like I said, my sobriety date is August 4th of 2005. And I'll start from the beginning. I got started very early. I'm a member of the CIA, Catholic Irish alcoholic. Whenever we were at a family function, you know, family holiday, there was always wine. My dad always drank beer with dinner. He's not an alcoholic. He's fully functional. You know, he can stop when he wants to. You know, recently he had some health problems, so he had to cut back on it. It was no big deal. So he didn't have to check into a hospital for a month or anything like that. He just stopped drinking, went to work the next day, and, you know, kept on. And that is one of the reasons that I'm alcoholic and he's not. But anyway, so I was about 5 or 6. I'm not sure exactly how old. It was Thanksgiving, and I got, you know, that much wine with dinner. But they put the bottle next to me, and no one was paying attention to me because no one expects a child that small to refill his own wine glass. But I figured it out, and I did. And I'm not sure how much I had, but, you know, I was all of maybe 50 pounds, so it didn't take too much, but I got drunk. And you know, once they realized what happened, they took the bottle away, and that would be a, you know, that comes up in my story. The bottle was often taken away. But I remember, that is probably one of my earliest memories. I don't have much more before that, but I can remember that in great detail. I can remember what we were eating, how I felt before, and how I felt after. And how I felt before was I was a self-seeking, self-centered kid. You know, I wanted all the attention, but I was real shy at the same time. You know, and all these people were coming over for Thanksgiving. You know, it was family. It was aunts and uncles and stuff. But I still felt like I was out of place, you know, whatever. It was still in my own house just because it was people that I didn't know that well. And then I got drunk and I felt fine and everybody was laughing at me and I thought it was the greatest thing in the world. And that was, you know, obviously at an early age like that, you're not going to become a daily drinker. But like I said, we would, my dad drinks and they would entertain and stuff like that. So we had a liquor cabinet. And I would get into that every once in a while when I was home. I was a latchkey kid for a little while, and you know I would drink occasionally. you know, just shots here and there, stuff that I had seen people doing on TV or at parties or stuff like that. And I would do that, but it was never like a problem. I never really got caught or in trouble for it. And when I was growing up, I was really decent at sports, and as long as it was just like me and my dad or me and my coach practicing and no one was paying attention to me, but I'd go out into the field and I'd freeze up. Because once again, I would start to think about what everybody was thinking about me. And that's just kind of how I lived my life. You know, that's just one example of where that would happen, but it would happen in school and everything else. And I never got along with the other kids. I would fight at the drop of a hat because I thought I had to prove myself. And until I learned the old trick of swallowing all that anger and that pain and all that raw emotion, shoving it down until I didn't react. And, you know, high school came around, and, you know, I was just doing all right, you know. I have a sister who does great at everything, so as long as I was doing all right and she was doing great, my parents were happy. And that was fine by me. And we were in a Catholic school all the way up until I was a sophomore in high school. And when I was a sophomore in high school, my sister went off to college. She went to a really good college, which cost my parents a lot of money. And they're not real wealthy people or anything like that. And at this point, I had kind of given up on learning anything. And I volunteered to go to public school, and they were like, okay, you know, because it would help save them some money. And that's at the same time as that, I got a job at a golf course. And washing golf carts. And going to the public school where it went from like having, you know, 500 kids in the whole school to 500 kids in my class, I realized that no one would notice if I was gone, so I could go and play hooky and smoke weed and drink and do the stuff that we like to do. And then at the golf course, I was around these guys who, you know, their profession was to play golf, so they drank. They knew how to drink, and they didn't mind teaching me how to drink. You know, it was just kind of not a problem for them. One of my jobs was like to go collect the kegs after the tournament. So I would just get lit at work all the time, and you know, there was no consequences hardly whatsoever. And I got my license soon after that because I had a job and I could afford to buy a car. And I immediately started drinking and driving. You know, it was natural. And thank God I never killed anybody. You know, I always say that. We hear the funny stories about it here, you know, but I've reflected back, and I'm in the auto body industry now. I've seen some horrific things because drinking and driving. That's one of the things that's always on my gratitude list, is that I didn't ever really hurt anybody, physically hurt anybody drinking and driving. I scared some people pretty badly. But I was 17. I had a fast car. I was selling weed and drinking every day, and I finally felt like it's like when Bill talks about I have arrived in the big book. Because I wasn't scared of people anymore. I could say what I wanted to say. I wasn't really worried about what you thought about me. You know, I was popular with the girls. One of my best friends growing up was on the football team, so I didn't really worry about people pushing me around because I wasn't the size I am now. I was like 5'10 and 120 pounds, so, you know, a strong wind could blow me over. But I certainly didn't act like that. You know, you would have thought I was the biggest giant in the world the way I talked to people, and it's a wonder I never really got hurt badly. But I had no regards to anybody else. I would go in your house and break things if we were at a party and your parents were out of town. If you were, you know, if the girl was in a relationship, I didn't care. You know, I would still pursue her as if she wasn't. You know, and that not only is that unprincipled to do, but it's also getting yourself lined up to get your butt kicked pretty good too. And I came close a couple times, but like I said, I had some friends that were pretty big, and they always kind of stepped up and was like, you know, leave him alone. He's just an idiot drunk, you know. And so I didn't see any kind of problems whatsoever. I was living good life and having a lot of fun, and finally felt okay, you know. And that was the big thing, you know. My mom would always be like, you know, what are you doing to yourself? You used to be such a nice kid and blah, blah, blah. And I'd just be like, Mom, for the first time in my life, I'm having fun. I'm accepted. I'm one of the kids. You know, I'm one of the cool kids or whatever. And And I was just tearing her heart out, because everything my mother and father had instilled in me as a child, I was just throwing out, you know what I mean? They didn't raise a drug dealing thief. You know, they tried to raise a good kid that did the right thing. But I disregarded that, and you know, I moved out of their house because I couldn't live it with their rules. You know, they had a big thing about tattoos, so I went and got one, and they were, you know, you're out. And I was like, okay. And during this whole time this is going on, my uncle's trying to get sober. And I remember distinctly, they would check him into rehab, and he would stay in rehab for a month. And everybody in here, I'm sure, knows someone who's done this. And on his way home from rehab, he'd go to the liquor store and get a bottle. And they couldn't understand. They'd be like, it's been 30 days, he's dry, he's going to go see his daughters. Why'd he go get a drink? I knew why he went and got a drink. Because he hadn't had one in 30 days, you know? And I was like, I never said anything, because I knew that was the big, like, you don't talk about that kind of stuff, you know, and then the attention will be on me. For now, it's on him. And unfortunately, he never made it here. I mean, he made it to the rooms, but he never made it here. He never got sponsored, never were the steps. And he died of DTs, you know? And that's what happens. You know, and that's, I'll bring that up here in a little bit, about how that relates into my story. But I knew, you know, so the attention's on him, I'm doing whatever I want, so I just slide out of the house, get a place of my own, and I'm alright, you know. I graduate high school, had no plans about college, and I just wanted to make quick money, you know. Like I said, I've been selling weed before, so I stepped it up, and I became a used car salesman. You know, they're right in line. The way I sold used cars, anyway. I don't know. I'm sure there's some guys out there who do it the principal way, but I was not. You know, that's where my drinking took off. I mean, really, like a daily drinker, because for the first time, I didn't have to really answer to anybody at home, and I could drink at work. They taught, you know, you'd have cocktails at lunch or whatever. And then after the close of business, we'd all sit around in the business office and drink and talk about work and everything. And, you know, you smooth the boss and everything. And then you drive home all lit up. And no one at my job cared, you know, what I was doing, as long as I was meeting my numbers. And I was good at it, you know. Like I said, I'm a liar, cheat, thief. And you know, that'll help you in sales if you want to, you know, if you want to sell like that. It'll catch up to you, but, you know, that's what I was doing. So I was drinking at work, and I was, you know, selling a lot of cars, and you know, everything was fine. And I just thought that I was, this was great. I don't understand why people don't all live like this, you know. And then right around that time, I got my first DWI. And I wasn't quite 21 yet, and I got pulled over, I felt it was an injustice because I didn't blow past the legal limit, but I wasn't 21, so the legal limit's zero, you know. And I grew up in a town that is similar to this, you know. It's in southern Maryland. It's rural. A lot of people know each other, so I get, you know, when I was drinking as a teenager, I'd get pulled over, and they'd be like, "Where do you live?" I'd be like, "Right there," and they'd be like, "Go home." You know, or they'd follow me home, or, you know, they'd say, "Go call somebody," and I'd just get let off the hook. And when I was getting arrested for the first time, I said that to the state trooper. I think that was my first mistake, was getting pulled over by a state trooper, not a sheriff. But I said, you know, most of the time this happens, let me go, you know. And he said, "Not this time, you're learning a lesson this time." So he stuck me in the front seat, and I was on some other stuff, and I think I bugged the hell out of him. So I was like, "What's that? And what does this do?" And everything else. And finally he got there, and he was like, "What is wrong with you?" I was like, "I don't know." He's like, "You just got arrested." I'm like, "I know." You know, I didn't care. I didn't see any consequences yet. And I got out of it. I went before the judge. He gave me a PBJ, a probation before judgment. He said, "Don't get in any trouble for a year, and this will all go away." And I had to do some community service at a park. Had to pay some fines, and I was off the hook, and I almost made it. right about a month before I was about to get off probation, I was leaving. By this time, I had turned 21. I was leaving the bar, and I was in those flash blackouts where you get a flash of what you're doing, and then you can't remember the flash. Well, the first flash is me promising the bartender I wouldn't drive home. The second flash is me getting in my car. And the third and final flash, because I remember everything else, was me standing outside of my car, and my car's wedged in between two pine trees. And it's in my neighborhood, so this is in someone's front yard. And my buddy was following me back to my house, the same house he lived in, and he pushed me out of the trees with his pickup and then pushed my car back to our house, which was, you know, just maybe 100 yards down the road with four flat tires. And then we went and hid in the house. Well, the police didn't have any trouble finding us. Didn't take, you know, the crack detectives to see the car. It was smoking and everything. It was just demolished. And so eventually I came outside and I confessed everything. You know, that remorse kicked in. I'm sorry. I did it. This is what I did. This is how much I've had. I gave myself up, blah, blah, blah. They didn't arrest me. They said, well, where do you work? And I told them where I worked. And they said, we'll be down at your work tomorrow to tell you, you know, what kind of charges, you know, you're in some trouble, but, you know, we're not going to take you to the police station. Well, that was a mistake because they never gave me a sobriety test. And I got out of it again. I got failure to repeat or to report an accident. I agreed to do 4 weekends in jail, and it was just no big deal once again. In fact, that was considered a moving violation. It doesn't even show up on my driving record, you know. And I could have really hurt somebody. You know, I was pretty close to someone's front door when I wrecked my car there. And that was all I needed to just live the way I wanted to live. I was like, whatever, you know. I obviously own this county, you know. I can do whatever I want. I know, you know, the judge was my baseball coach when I was a kid, and I can just kind of do whatever I want. Man, I tell you, I don't know if I cursed myself when I said that, but things didn't go well after that. Because this is, you know, I went on for a few more years, and things progressively got worse. You know, because I was like way up here, you know, and life was great, and I slowly started to lose the things that I valued. And the things I valued back then weren't things that I value now. They were having a nice car, having a pretty girlfriend, the way I looked, having money, stuff like that. First, the car went, you know, because I'd run it into stuff all the time. And so I just figured I'm going to stop fixing these things because, you know, killing my bank account. And then, you know, the girls didn't really want to be around me because I was just, you know, I was a pig when I drank, you know. I would just drink and smoke and snort everything I could come across, you know. And I'd get to the point where I couldn't talk and, you know, I'd just be like comatose in the corner. And that's not a very entertaining date, you know. And so I was getting a little lonely. I was getting quite bloated and fat, you know. I finally balked up when I turned about 21. I was like, oh, this is cool. I hadn't done anything to do it. And then within 2 years, I'm like, I'm really overweight and bloated. I don't smell that great because I don't take that good care of myself. And so the only thing I really have left is my job, you know. But by this time, I had lost all that stuff that I value. So all that stuff about people thinking, what do they think about me, and being nervous around people, all that started to come back. And it didn't really matter how much I drank. It would still be there the next day. On top of all those people I had hurt, because at this point I had ran into some other people's cars and took off and stuff like that. And I thought people were going to come and were looking for me and stuff. And I was really paranoid. And I was just paranoid, scared, and didn't know what to do. You know, and because I couldn't bring this to my parents. And they were the smartest people I knew. But I couldn't go to them and tell them that, you know, I was what a mess I was. And I was living in the basement of this woman. She was renting me out a room in the basement. And she got pregnant and she told me I had to go because she didn't want to have any kid being around any kind of person like me. And that's devastating to somebody who thinks they're a nice guy. And I was like, all right, well, I guess I'm going to move out. And at the same time, the job said, you got to find something else. You know, we love you to death, Dave, but we can't help you. We're just trying to, you know, you're just on a track that we can't turn this around. And they let me go, and I understood that and everything. So went down to my folks' house. They moved out of this town by now, and got a place in the water, and they were doing real good. Now my sister had graduated college, and I was somewhat self-supporting. And I said, you know, I got kicked out, and I'm sure I wove some tale how I was wronged. You know, I didn't let them know of all the horrible stuff I had done. You know, I just and they said, well, you know, my mom had wanted me to stop selling cars for a long time. She felt that was the problem, and she thought that I needed to learn how to work with my hands and get a good role model. And she was right, you know, to a degree. And she said, but there's this guy. He's going to retire in a few years. He does handyman stuff. Why don't you go work for him? I know he needs a helper, and we'll get you a place. You know, get you on your feet. And I started doing that. About a week into it, I came over to their house for dinner, and there was a tow truck sitting in the driveway. I thought, that's kind of weird. Well, it turns out the people that were looking for me was the repo company, and the guy came. He got my truck right there in my parents' driveway. And that's when another time of remorse, and I'm going to let you know everything I've been doing. And I let them know, you know, and they said, well, you know, well, this is it. We'll bail you out one last time, but you got to get some help. You got to do something. You got to get your drinking under control. You got to stop doing cocaine. You got to stop smoking weed, all this. You got to stop hanging out with those people, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, whatever. Whatever you want me to do. And I called my buddy up. He was in AA for a few years now, and I said, Brian, I need to go to a meeting. And he was like, all right, come on, you know, meet me here. And he took me to a meeting. And I think I went to like two or three meetings. I never picked up the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I never did any of the steps. And I got all my stuff back. I got a brand new apartment. I had this job, and I got my truck back. And you'd think with having my car back, it'd be a lot easier to go to meetings, but it got a lot harder. You know what I mean? Because that bar was a lot closer. You know what I mean? I was living in a strange town. I didn't really know anybody. Where do you go to meet people? You go to the bar, you know? And I was going to the bar, drinking Diet Cokes, and talking to people. And, you know, I remember the day it happened. It was no surprise to anybody. I had been hanging out at this bar for a few weeks, drinking Diet Cokes, and finally I said, let me get a beer. And they were like, okay, we've been waiting. You know what I mean? Because they could tell that I was just, you know, white-knuckling, not drinking, watching everybody have fun and me not, you know. And it was just a couple of months. That happened in, I don't know, March or something like that. And like I said, in March of 2005, and like I said, my sobriety date is August 4th of 2005. So it went from having everything, my life back into order, and then I started drinking. And by August, I had lost everything again. You know, same exact situation, except for I blew the motor in the truck this time instead of the repo man gave, but still paperweight, you know what I mean? I had lost my job with this guy because he couldn't put up with me because I was such ass, you know what I mean? He had been doing this for 40-some years, and I was, like, trying to run the show, and he was just like, get out of here. You know what I mean? I can do this better myself. I was like, all right. So I didn't want that job anyway. And well, he owned the apartment that I was living in, so I had to move. And I didn't have anywhere to go. I didn't have any money because I had been drinking. You know, as soon as I got paid, everything would go away. You know, all the money would go away. And I didn't know what to do. And my parents, like I said, they said, we're not helping you. This is the last time. So I didn't ask them for any help, and I just was kind of like, well, we'll see what happens, you know. And I lived that way for just a couple weeks, you know, hanging, mooching off people and stuff like that. And I got a call from my mom. She was like, look, you know, I told you that we wouldn't help you again, but she said, somebody's got to be around when I'm old. You know, somebody, your sister's going to just going to be living her life, and you know, I want somebody to be around when I'm old and take care of me. You know, that kind of, you know, it's funny because it talks about in working with others, where you hit him when he's right off a drunk, you know, and that's what she did. She called me in the morning. I had drank all night the night before, and I was not feeling good. I was very hungover, very confused, you know, because when I was drinking, all the voices were quiet for a little while, and when I sober off, they would hit me tenfold. And so she called me right when all of this, I'm sick to my stomach. You know, I got all this doubt, remorse going on, and she calls me and says this to me, and I said, well, I don't know what to do, Mom. You know, I've tried to quit drinking many times. And she said, well, you know, there's that free rehab up in Montgomery County. And she had that newspaper article. They ran it, NIH, National Institute of Health, has a rehab program. They run an ad in the Washington Post. And she had cut the ad out like 5 years prior and hung it up on the refrigerator. And she would mention it occasionally, and I'd just be like, whatever, I'm not going to rehab. You saw what it did for Uncle Jim. It's not going to do anything for me. But this time, she had said that. I didn't know where I was going to live in a few weeks anyway, and it was free. And I was like, well, maybe I'll try it. I don't know what else to do. Maybe it'll be a good end to the summer, like a camp or something, you know? And I was figuring I'd go in there, I'd get in shape. I was like, well, it's an National Institute of Health, so they got to have a gym, and like it was an awesome facility, you know what I mean? And I was right. It had all of that stuff. And they let us use it, and it was great. You know, they had a team of psychiatrists, and they taught us about alcoholism, and I had my own nurse and everything else, They it was a 28-day program. And our days would consist of, we'd get up, we'd eat breakfast, we'd have a meeting amongst the members of the rehab. We'd have classes. Couldn't tell you what a single one of them were about. We'd have some kind of activity, and they'd do things like take us bowling and take us, you know, to the museum. What did that have to do with sobriety? I have no idea. Come back to the hospital, eat, take care of household stuff, and then they would take us to a meeting outside of the rehab, and they would take us to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And I'm a big believer in H&I. I love to go in to a hospital, into a homeless shelter, into a psych ward, tell my story. Talk to the people that can't get sober or just getting sober. In fact, I do it every Tuesday. I go to a meeting. I don't even have a position. I go into a hospital, and I just because I know that's when people are seeking the most help. That's most of the time, and that's when I was. And I lucked out because one of the guys who was in this meeting or in this rehab. This was like his third rehab, and he was my age. And he had gotten involved. He lived in Montgomery County all his life, and he had gotten involved in Midtown. And he said, "Can we go to this meeting called Promises? It's on Monday nights." You know, there was me, this guy Malcolm, this guy Russ, and a few other younger people. And he said, "It's right down the street here." And since there's some young people in the rehab, can we just go to a young person's meeting? And they're like, "Yeah, sure, no problem." So they took us to this meeting, and all the meetings we had been to before were doing the things that I talked about at the beginning of my talk, sticking their hands out, you know, to ask us, you know, what brought us to rehab and stuff like this. But for the first time, I was face-to-face with guys that looked like me. They were my age. And you know, the same mannerisms, everything, you know. And I was like, huh. You know, because all the young people I knew drank, you know. And they pushed us to get phone numbers and pushed us to get a sponsor. And I think the second week back at being that meeting, I met a guy named Joel. And he had been in the Army, you know, and he just seemed to kind of have his stuff together. And I was like, well, you know, will you be my temporary sponsor until I, you know, go back home? Because I was planning on going back down to Virginia. When I got out of there, and he was like, yeah, sure, you know. So I started calling him, and he had me start reading a little bit of the big book. And before I got out of rehab, you know, they wanted to make sure I had a plan, so they brought my folks up, and they were discussing halfway houses, in different places I could live once I got out of rehab. And I was like, screw that. I am not going to live in a halfway house. I'm going back home. I'm going back to Colonial Beach, Virginia. And the guy that was mediating this like meeting looked at my parents. They didn't look at me. Looked at my parents and said, Dave's been doing whatever Dave wants until all his life. And if he continues to do that, he's going to die. And that was the beginning of my third step. Because I realized he was right. And I realized that if I didn't start listening to some other people, that I was going to die. I was going to end up like my Uncle Jim. And once I got out of rehab, go right there to the liquor store. So I went bed to bed, which means I went from the bed in the rehab to the bed in the men's home. And it was, I think, the best move I could have done was not go back. And I know we talk about a lot in here is geographics won't cure you. I believe that 100%. If you go someplace and you continue to act the same way you were acting before, you'll get the same results. But I didn't go back home. I moved to Old Town Alexandria, got into a rehab, started going to meetings every day. And I was scared out of my mind. Every day felt like the first day of kindergarten almost. I would get on the metro and I'd just be like, for the first time in my life, I'm living in the city, for one thing. And there's tall buildings and there's a million people. I'd get on the metro and freak out. And all internally, I had managed, I could keep my composure. But I would just go straight to the meeting. I'd go to the early bird meeting, before I started working. And I would get in there and be like, all right, cool. I'm not going to drink in here, And these people accept me. By this time I had been coming to AA meetings for a month. So I knew the language. I knew, what to do and put my seat away and everything. So I felt, comfortable in AA meeting. And then I would go ride the metro up to Bethesda. I would catch a noon. And I'd be okay once I got into the noon. And then, usually at the noon there would be somebody that was off that day or wasn't working. And I'd just hang out with him until the night meeting. And I'd go to three meetings a night for the first couple weeks of my sobriety just because I didn't have much going on. And if I wasn't hanging with some other member of AA, I was in my sponsor's back pocket, because he was teaching me how to live sober. And I didn't realize this is what he was doing at first. I came to realize it after he did. But he wasn't teaching me, you need to do this and you need to do that and you need to be over there. He was showing me how he lived. He was teaching me directly from his experience. He was showing me how to interact with people, at Starbucks, at the restaurants, in traffic and stuff like that. And when it was just me and him, it wasn't, I thought, this guy's my age, we'll have a lot in common, we'll be buddy-buddy. It was this book. We were reading this book and we were doing the steps. And obviously I got a job. I couldn't continue to just mooch off my parents. That's one of the things we do here is we become self-supporting. And I got a job at Toys R Us. I was putting together bicycles. It was like the high point of my life. I was 60 days sober, and I was putting together bicycles, listening to country music, and I would just break out into tears. I didn't know why. It was horrible. I had moved out of the men's home into a house with this guy, Captain Bill. He may have been up here at some point. He had a room open up in his townhouse. He was a member of my home group, and he was like, you can rent a room for me, and he cut me a deal so I could afford it, working at Toys R Us. I didn't have a bed. I had an air mattress, and I hadn't lost any of that weight yet either, so eventually that went flat. Didn't have a car. I couldn't get enough money to buy one of the bicycles I was putting together, so I was walking to work, back and forth to work, and it was, half a mile. I needed the exercise big time, and I remember one day I was walking in the rain, and it was, by this time it was fall time. It was probably right around this time of year, and it was a little chilly, it was raining, so I was cold, and I was thinking, man, I should be pissed off right now, but I wasn't. I was okay with it. For the first time in my life, I had started to experience something I hadn't felt in a long time, and that was hope. I had been coming around here long enough, listening to you guys' stories long enough to feel like I could get this. That if I continued to do what everybody else around me was doing, because I had surrounded myself with people in Alcoholics Anonymous, that I would have a shot at it. And And the things that I thought, you know, that wanted them, I would have shortchanged myself. But eventually, you know, I got in the car with somebody to go to a meeting with, and we were just talking, you know, and I told him I used to sell cars. And he said, oh, you know how to sell stuff? I said, yeah. He said, well, I work at Nordstrom. Why don't you come work at Nordstrom? And I was like, okay, you know, that's fine. And it was kind of cool. Because he was one of the managers, and there was probably, I don't know, 5 or 6 of us there that were all sober, you know what I mean? So I got to learn how to work sober. I got to learn how to sell stuff without, you know, pulling the wool over someone's eyes and just being nice to people and everything. It was a great opportunity. I stayed there for a couple of years, and I, you know, things were good. And you know, at this point, right around that same time, I did my 4th and 5th step with Joel, and I came face to face. You know, like I said, I had all these stories about how I had been wrong. You know, how, you know, my parents have my truck now, and that's why I can't drive to meetings, blah, blah, blah. And I wrote all of that down, all those resentments and all that stuff that I had blamed everybody for. And then I did that 4th column and realized that all that stuff that I thought people had done, I had really wronged them. And this is a list of what was wrong with me. Why I thought that you guys didn't like me, and why I thought, you know, I was the worst, the lowest scum in the world. And for a couple years there, I went with thinking that, all right, I would pick, it would be like the defect of the month. Me and God are going to work on this defect, you know, and it really it doesn't work like that. It's I have to realize that I'm just a garden variety drunk. I'm no better or less than any man on this earth, or woman, any person on this earth, and I'm just one of God's kids, you know. And that's, if I'm one of God's kids, then He can have me all, you know. And it's just like the prayer says, good and bad. And, you know, I still have blaring defects, a lot of them, you know what I mean? But I'm okay with them now. You know, I don't get to pick which ones that God's going to get rid of. I don't get to pick which ones are going to help you, you know what I mean? Because I'm sure people look at me sometimes and they're like, man, I don't want to be like that guy, so they don't act like me, you know. And... excuse me. So, I was working in Nordstrom. I was making some decent money, and I was paying some of my men's down. You know, the silly ones that are just money. That's DMV, IRS. You know, places that I had ripped off or stuff like that, where you just write the check and you're done with it. You know what I mean? That's easy. You know, the hardest part about that is, like, not spending the money on something that I wanted and just giving the money back to the person who it belongs to. And I made my direct amends to my family, to my mom and my dad. And it was funny because when I made my amends to my mom, she was like, I've been waiting for this, you know, burning bush. Everything's great between us. And everything is great between us. It was great between us before I made the amends. I just had to come out and I had to do it, you know, and make sure there was nothing. Because basically what I did was I set myself up for her to make sure that there wasn't anything that I needed to take care of that I didn't even realize. You know what I mean? And I told her, I gave her my bed, and then I said, what do you need from me? And she said the same thing, but I just want somebody to take care of me when I'm old. You know, it's a done deal. When I made the amends with my father, my dad's not emotional. It was a soldier. He said, you need to go to church, and you need to get married. And I was like, that'll happen. 18 months later, I'm a parishioner, and I'll be getting married July 9th of 2011. He's never been wrong, Never. He's like my sponsor. I've been trying all my life to prove him wrong, and those two men, for some reason, they got my number, and they can just tell me, you know, what I need to hear. But anyway, so I got another job. My love, my passion is cars. I love cars. I've always have. I like working on them. I like being around them. I like talking about them. I like driving in them. I like, you know, selling them. If it's got to do with cars, I'm in. You know what I mean? And there was this guy that I knew that was also a member of my home group, and he worked at an auto body shop, and I just think that's just the neatest. You watch something be wrecked, and you get to put it back together, and he worked in the front office. I said, "Jeff, man, I really want to do what you do." I said, "Do you know anybody that can get my foot in the door? I'll sweep floors, whatever." He said, "Actually, I was going to hire somebody to answer the phones tomorrow, but I'm literally looking for somebody I can train, and they can be my assistant." And he hired me to do that, and I was, you know, I was doing what I wanted to do career-wise as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous and with another sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he taught me how to do that. And now, I don't do it for the same company. He realized he wanted to go back to college, and he left the company, and I got a job with a chain, you know, with a lot more opportunity. And my life, like I said, when I was walking home in the rain there, I felt hope. I just, you know, all I thought was I could get sober. And now I have all these things of material. You know, I have this awesome car. I have this, you know, I'm getting ready to buy a house, which is a far step from an air mattress that won't hold air. You know, I have a fiance. I have, you know, all the stuff, you know. And that can really get in the way sometimes, too. Don't get me wrong. I'm not ungrateful. I love that stuff. You know, it's great that I have it, and I have the opportunity to have it. But I'll tell you what, the thing that I'm most grateful for is the relationship with my higher power. And then it's the fact that I'm sober today and the friends I have in my life. Noah rode up with me today. Noah's one of my closest friends now. I moved to Virginia about 18 months ago or so, and we started hanging out a lot. And, you know, it's relationships like that where I can say anything to him and not feel that he's coming from a place of judgment if he gives me any advice or his experience or anything like that. And you don't get that in the bar, you know what I mean? You don't sit down next to some dude at the bar and say, "Man, I'm really sensitive today." You know? You know, it just doesn't work. Especially the bars I hung out with, you know. I hung out at, so the people I hung out with. You know, but Noah, he'll just be, "Dude, just go eat a cheeseburger. You'll be fine." You know what I mean? Or if that's not what it is, we'll talk about what's going on. You know what I mean? Because my sponsor's not there 24/7. You know, I changed sponsors. I got that guy's sponsor, and because my head got in the way from listening to him, and I'm a jerk. It's basically what happened. So I had to get a new sponsor, and so, you know, Jack's taking me through the steps, and now, you know, I know how to live sober. You know, I have go-to guys if I can't get a hold of Jack, because he's busy too, and I have this relationship with my higher power. And it's all great, and this is kind of where I'm at, coming out of right now. Is, you know, I'm sober, 5 years sober. I've got the wife, I've got the house, I've got the job, I've got the car, got the relationship with my higher power. I can't think of anything else I'd want except for a boat. I've got mine. What do you do? And I forgot the biggest part of the sobriety, in my opinion. It was when I went to a meeting and people stuck their hands out to me, showed me where the coffee was, sat me down, gave me a big book, took me through the big book, listened to me when I was hurting, you know, helped me all those times I moved, helped me get jobs. That's what I need to do with all that stuff, is just give it away, you know. And I realized once again, and I ebb and flow with this all the time, you know, because life gets busy and I forget stuff. That's why I have a sponsor, you know, is that if I'm not giving it away, I just get in this spot where I don't want to go to a meeting. I don't want to talk to anybody. Everybody thinks I'm different again. And that's the big red flag. And as the more sober I get, the easier it is to feel that. And if I'm not only do I have to go to a meeting every day, five times a week, whatever your schedule is, it's what I'm doing at the meeting too. You know what I mean? Because a lot of you have been up to our group. It's 400 people. I got a lot of friends. I got a lot of people I can talk to. You know, I can get in. I can be guilty of getting in that circle and talking about stuff with my friends. And meanwhile, there's a guy over there in the corner. He's never been to an AA meeting before, and he doesn't know that he can just walk up and get in the circle. You know what I mean? And it's my job to go over there and make sure he feels welcome to the meeting and knows that he can come in and get into the circle. And I introduce him to the people, so when next time he's around, at least he knows one or two names. You know what I mean? And another big thing for me too is service. You know, I've had tons and tons of service. It's ever since I got sober, I was doing everything. My first service position was taking out trash. And I've gone all the way up to, like, area level. I'm going to be a big shot. I'm going to be a delegate, blah, blah, blah. I'm going to be the youngest delegate ever. All this crap, all these grandiose ideas. And I've realized that the best service is taking out the trash and making the coffee and the stuff that people won't see me doing, because that helps me keep humble. And it the real meaning behind it is we get to have the meeting, you know, and we don't necessarily see the people doing it, but we know it happens if you've been coming around here, and it brings somebody that's coming to AA, allows them to come to the meeting and be comfortable and be happy. So I'm going to end a little bit early. Sorry, Billy. But that's all I got. Thank you.